Hello and welcome to Sense in Numbers, a podcast created and hosted by two people who have varying levels of experience in mental health issues. We are not mental health professionals, we just want to create a format for people to listen, share and find support in. Each episode will concentrate on different aspects of mental health illness, treatment and experience.
We also feel it pertinent to deliver a trigger warning due to the subject matter of the podcast. You may hear some distressing details and stories. There will also be some mature language and possibly my squeaky crying voice, so listener discretion is advised.
Hello, welcome to Sense in Numbers. My name's Ben.
I'm just going to go with Gemma, I can't think of anything funny.
That's grand. Apologies for being away so long. It's been a while. Gem's going to fill you in as to why it's been a while.
Yep, there are some logistical reasons, for want of a better phrase. We started recording back in September for World Suicide Prevention Day, and the vast majority of the content in this episode is...
Hello, welcome to Sense in Numbers. My name's Ben.
I'm just going to go with Gemma, I can't think of anything funny.
That's grand. Apologies for being away so long. It's been a while. Gem's going to fill you in as to why it's been a while.
Yep, there are some logistical reasons, for want of a better phrase. We started recording back in September for World Suicide Prevention Day, and the vast majority of the content in this episode is still related to that because we thought that it was useful and we don't want to wait until September this year. But also we both had COVID in October, I want to say, or around that time, were quite unwell. Then at the start of December, we very sadly lost our perfect pooch, Misha. Then I was in Jordan for a little bit, and then we got our new terrific pooch. I couldn't think of a word for a dog that started with a T. Truffle, who has joined the slaughterhouse.
Or Bismo Funyuns.
Bismo Funyuns. Are you going to explain that?
No, I want you to talk more about Misha.
Well, that's fine, but we should probably explain.
No.
Okay. Yes, Misha, all of our dogs are rescue dogs. We still have three now, obviously, because we got Truffle recently. And we got Misha, actually, as a wedding present to one another. Because I was working at a rather unhelpful workplace. Being very careful with what I say. At the time that we got married, and they said, oh, there's no way you're going to be able to have a honeymoon because we have too much training that we need to do. Oh, really? But that's what they said. So we didn't book a honeymoon. And 2 days after we got married, we went and picked up Misha. And the plan was to foster her temporarily because I was going to deploy to Afghanistan.
And we weren't allowed dogs.
Well, that's by the by. Clearly that didn't matter. Yeah, so we were going to foster her temporarily, and then before I went away, a family got in touch and said they wanted to meet her with a view to adopting her, and I started crying because dogs are amazing. And Misha was just, she was smarter than most people I know. I absolutely adored her. And Ben's mum was in the house when this happened. I should say Ma when I talk about your mum.
Yeah, you should.
Sorry about that. It's significant because my mother-in-law Carol was actually bitten by a German Shepherd when she was younger, and she was really, really scared of them. And Misha was a German Shepherd Collie cross, but she just looked like a smaller version of a German Shepherd. Yeah. So if you were scared of German Shepherds, you're fucked. And she was, but she was just so special. She was such an important soul to exist in this world. And she saw how upset I was, and knowing that I was about to deploy for, we thought, 6 months, and Ben was working really long shifts in the kitchen, she knew it was completely unfeasible for us to keep her, and she said that she would have her while I went away so that we could keep her in our lives at the very least. And I straight away said, if I come back after 6 months and she barely remembers me and she's happier with you, then that's absolutely fine. I just don't want to not have her in my life. And then I suppose in this circumstance you could say, fortuitously, I came home with cancer after only 2 and a bit months, And so she remembered me straight away and jumped all over me and won a Best Companion Award for being by my side while I was poorly. And she was just absolutely magnificent and the best dog ever.
And to that point, being the best dog ever, she almost brought my mum out of that fear of dogs and
absolutely.
Was by her side, used to walk with her in the park, just completely neutralised that fear. And no other dog could do that apart from Mish Petitions.
No.
And she's greatly missed. I know you think about her every day. I know Denzel thinks about her every time he goes to the toy box and gets something out of there being bitch slapped around her. Quite substantial head he's got. But she's missed.
Double paw.
But yeah, she was. That took a great, great toll on you, didn't it?
Oh, it really did. And it still is. And I don't, you know, Truffle is in no way a replacement. And my dad was like, what are you doing getting another dog? Why don't you just leave it for 5 minutes? But my response was then and is still now, if there is room in my home and my heart for another soul, then I don't see why any being should suffer anywhere, be in unsuitable circumstances or in kennels or out on the street. I don't care what the situation is. If there's room, then we'll take them.
And, and that's wonderful. And you've always been like that. But there is one quibble I'd like to raise. The pictures you sent me, right, she looked a normal sized dog, right? So when this dog turned up, Jen went and got her from I don't know where, and brought her back. She brought a polar bear back with some badonk donk, and she is the clumsiest, most unaware hound we've ever come across, isn't she?
Is she unaware than Denzel?
Yes. She's got crazy.
She's
bonnet
very clumsy.
Hair.
She's uncoordinated. Yep.
But like Gemma said, if there's a place in our home and Gemma's heart not to, then they're always welcome. So yeah, I think that's good enough reason, isn't it?
Yeah. I won't talk about shenanigans because she gets a mention in the main.
Yeah, she does. She does.
Bit.
And also, another reason, Jen, I never ever think that it's a case of we don't want to record or we can't be bothered. Jem is constantly asking me, do I want to record? You know, should we record? And I will always say, yep, that's a great idea. And then try and think of something facile to get out of it, falling down the stairs or getting COVID, because it's just not something that is always going to be on top of my list. I love putting the podcast out because it's cathartic for me. And I've been told that it helps people as well, which is even bigger reason to do it. I just don't always want to sit there and talk about how mentally hilarious I am. And it's quite physically draining. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it is quite physically draining sitting there and talking about something that sometimes you spend weeks ignoring. But with Gemma's support, as usual, we've dug it out and we've got one right lined up for you.
I don't think it sounds ridiculous to people who understand those kind of struggles, by the way. I think they can absolutely get on board with not wanting to put headphones on and talk about your deepest, darkest feelings. but we've got some good shit here.
Yeah, we have. And you need to have it.
Yeah.
Not you. They need to have it.
So here is the little segment we recorded back in September for World Suicide Prevention Day. And so a couple of the dates are off. So we might say last year and actually it was the year before and so on and so forth. But you should be able to follow it.
We're mixing it up this time, aren't we? We're recording in the kitchen.
Yeah. Not sure how it's going to work, really. Cause it's a tippy-tappy floor.
Fine. I think if it doesn't work out and the audio quality is terrible, what people can do is complain and get their money back. Yeah, so we are, what's this episode?
I think it's episode seven.
It's episode seven. Shall we, I think this is the closest we've recorded episodes together and I'm uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable with this level of regularity.
But it's World Suicide Prevention Day,
it
which is why
is.
We are keen to record today. Look, I told you the floor was too tippy-tappy.
Yes, so if you do hear like Al Jolson in the background, it's not him, it's
all
our dogs.
Our dogs.
But you know what? It gives some kind of authenticity to what we're doing. Yeah, we're in a home, not in a studio, so you will hear some things. You might even hear
a
couple of dog farts or a queef. You know, you never know. And what did I say to you today? We were sitting and we were having dinner and I said, we need a name for the listeners. And what did you say?
I said, the Sensationals.
So from now on, you 13 people are affectionately known.
I like how it goes up at least one every time you mention.
You're affectionately known as the Sensationals. And I'd like to call out a few Sensationals, if that's all right.
Go for it.
We have some Sensationals that listen to us and they kind of stay in the background. They don't make themselves known, not very prominent, but I've been informed that they listen and we're incredibly thankful of their support and their ears, their ear time. I just want them to know that we're very appreciative. So yeah, that's our new phrase that we're going to use, our term for the people that listen. You are our Sensationals and you are quite sensational.
Absolutely.
We got your backs, keep going. Today is quite pertinent as well because it is
World Suicide Prevention Day. Sorry.
WSP. That's what me and my friends have been calling it. WSPD. No, because I don't know that. That's but yeah, so it's WSP. So
World Suicide Prevention.
Yeah. Comma. Day. You should know by now, by episode 7, the reason why we're doing this.
Of course.
Have you anything to add about the day and its relevance? And
I have loads to add about the day. I'd like to, I don't know if she actually, I know she has listened on occasion, don't she regularly listens, but I'd like to send my love to my sister today, who got a very, very pertinent tattoo, which included daisies, and that was our mum's favourite flower. If anybody hasn't listened to that, I think it was the very first episode when I spoke about it, but my mum took her own life. This year is 12 years.
Yeah, that's a lovely thing for your sister to do. And I'm fully aware that people grieve and feel differently when these things happen. And it's nice that she's done something very subtle but quite prominent, that tattoo. I really like it. If you don't mind me asking, do you think this would be a good time for you to share your experiences of what you went through when you lost your mum and you know, the kind of experiences you had and what you dealt with? And what you saw other people doing with, well, is this a good time to talk about it?
Yeah, I think so. I know we spoke recently about perhaps talking about this anyway, and I'm not going to lie, things skip by you, even though I do a lot to do with mental health. I only became aware that it was World Suicide Prevention Day because it came up on my time hop, because I've obviously shared things in years past. But yeah, I think it is probably a good time to talk about the events leading up to that day, which was my first experience of suicide, really. I mean, I knew of people who had taken their own lives in the past, but my first close experience.
Before then, sorry to interrupt you, but before then, did you have any exposure to people that were suffering from mental health issues, or was that your first experience? Were you a mental health virgin?
It was my first conscious experience. Okay. I definitely, knowing what I know now and how much so many people struggle, I definitely had been around it. I don't think I'd appreciated it before then. And sadly, because of how upsetting and difficult those events were, I think it took me a long time to then be able to help people who were in that place. And I would have loved to have been able to do that straight away, but that's not realistic. You know, you have to take time to grieve and to heal and then to kind of gather yourself and say, what am I going to do about it? And you can just grieve and heal and you can carry on doing all the things you were doing before. But I felt I needed to do something extra, which is why I branched out into the kind of stuff that I do. Lucy tippy tapping around. Lie down, shenanigans, lie down. I know I've mentioned it in the past, but I think today might be the day when I sort of talk through the events. And the reason it's so important to me actually ties into the reason that we do this podcast in the first place, and obviously your situation in May last year. And that's because despite all of the training and everything that I'd done, I still found myself unwittingly within moments of losing someone incredibly close to me for a second time. And I really want to let everybody know that no matter how hard you try and no matter how much you care and how available you are, sometimes you just lose people and it's not your fault.
I cannot agree with you more. I think that whenever somebody feels that there are that's the solution, it's not because they're not thinking about anyone else. I know we've mentioned it before.
Yeah.
But it's never... It would be a huge miscalculation and generalisation for me to say that someone that has committed suicide feels that they don't have anyone, because that would be... You know, I can't... There's nothing empirical I can turn around and say, yeah, that's fact. But what I will say is that whenever someone who has mental health issues gets to that point, they don't feel like there's no one there. They just feel like this life is not for them. And
actually that they make it worse by being here there, for those people that they do care about. That's my experience. But
they feel like they're doing
you a favour.
I don't
mean to project, because I've not been in that position. So that, from people speaking to me who've been in that position, that's the feeling that I get. I'm not trying for one moment to pretend that I understand how they felt. I don't. But I will try my very best to be non-judgmental and to keep them around even that one extra day where they wake up and are grateful for being here.
Which is wonderful, and is what you have done consistently for as long as I've known you. Would you mind talking about the events of that day and how you felt and how it impacted you afterwards?
I can try. I remember that we'd gone to... I was going to say a local bar, but actually it's not really that local to most of us. It was local to Murrin, which is of supreme importance. And actually, I think Bully was still living with him then, so it's probably...
They lived together?
Yeah.
Oh, I bet that was a horrible, carlingy, spermy cesspit.
I'm not going to pass comment on that. But a few of our friends and a few of our family, because Auntie Gail and Christy, I think, were still living in that area at the time, were just across the road from this pub. So it was a beautiful August summer's day. And we were all there just having, you know, beer garden drinks, a really good day. Remember, I think my dad was taking the piss out of Bully because he couldn't whistle. And then we had a whistle off and we were recording it. So I got videos still of this whistling competition, and my mum was there. And then I suppose, I mean, by starting on that day, I skip an awful lot. That my mom had a very difficult childhood. Her dad died when she was 2 from leukemia, and her mom, and I truly hope, even if my mom's siblings are listening to this, that nobody's upset by what I say, but my experience of my nan was that she was rather unhinged. And I don't know whether it's that she was just that way anyway, or because she'd lost her husband with 4 young children at the time.
Not unhinged in a kind of laughable, oh, she's unhinged, she's
no,
put
eggs
in my trousers again.
Quite concerning. And my mum had a really difficult upbringing. And she had a wonderful stepdad who we knew as granddad, you know, all of our lives. And he was lovely, but I don't think those wounds ever really healed. And she was not a contented child. And she left home quite young and married my older sister's dad. And by saying that, obviously, I'm kind of saying she's technically my half-sister, but she was already there when I was born. She's the eldest of the 3 of us. To me, she's just my sister.
Yeah.
It's not.
And she always has been that to you.
Not. I never say I've got a brother and a half-sister. She's my sister. And then met my dad, or mine and Chris's dad, I suppose, down in Cornwall. And she was still quite young. She was a couple of years older than my dad. I think she had probably her happiest times in those interim years, but it was still incredibly difficult mentally because she'd had such a difficult upbringing. And then she was diagnosed with both rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia, which in themselves can make people incredibly depressed, because chronic pain is one of the leading causes of depression and associated mental health issues. So she had more than her fair share, I think, to
Indeed.
Deal with over the years. Then at some point when I think I was in my late teens, maybe, she went over to Cyprus, I think with my dad. And it becomes a bit blurry when something really traumatic happens and you kind of try and piece it together afterwards to make sense of everything, but I can't be certain about a lot of it. But I think they went on holiday there, and because of her chronic pain conditions, my mom felt so much better in those climates that when they got back, she couldn't bear to be in our hideous climate and everything that it does to people with chronic pain, and kind of up sticks and went and moved over there without my dad. And so they were separated for a time. And my brother took that the hardest because he was still, I think he was 16 going on 17 in a Sound of Music kind of way.
Can I interrupt for one moment? Do you feel that you, do you understand her decision to leave a bit more now that you have?
Fucking absolutely. Because
we've recently returned from a holiday in Malta where I might be talking out of turn, but it's the greatest test to our marriage since we've been together. And I understand more now. And I know it should be clear for everyone to understand that the older you get, the more you know, the more accepting you become and the more tolerant and patient you are.
Well, most decent people.
But I remember you said something to me when we were in Malta and it resonated with me because I thought for a normal year, you are probably home for 50 weeks and then you try and fit a holiday in there, you know, wherever you can. It's never about getting away and it's never about just escaping your job because you love your job, but you're not escaping your home life because you have a fantastic home life. It's you having normality or like a version of normality for a week where you're not in pain and your bones aren't hurting because rain's coming in 3 days. And does that lend any kind of credence to having a better understanding of your mum's situation then?
Yeah, I have this time hop that comes up, and it wasn't long after she passed away I shared it, and every time it comes up I just think, you know, samesies, I suppose, that if nothing else, I would love to explain to her that I understand her now. I understand the decisions that she made. I wouldn't say I understand why she felt the need to leave us, and that's really because I've never personally been suicidal, but I can understand the amalgamation of all the pain and trauma of her entire life, which amplified in her later years.
We met before it happened, but then we got together quite soon after you lost her, and it wasn't until I confronted my own issues with your help that I realised just how much you'd taken from this horrific experience and used it for the most positive reasons. And I've never encountered that before. Normally it takes people years and years and years of either counselling or therapy or just suffering until they get to that point where they think, no, I'm going to use this as a reason for good. And you did that. I'm always, always bowled over by your desire to ensure that no one goes through it alone. Whether they lose people or they don't, or they're on the precipice or they're not alone. And that's incredibly impressive.
You just have to normalise it.
So for you, it was just a normal day. Everyone was there. Nothing. You didn't see or feel like anything was bubbling under the surface?
Definitely not in a kind of nefarious or negative way. Actually, it was a really good day. But since I've done the training that I've done, I am more alert to the fact that most people who have struggled for a really, really long time, when they come to that conclusion that that's what they're going to do, actually, that's a really, you know, it's a relief. It's a great day for them, and they think that it's going to be a great day for all the people around them for whom they think they're a burden. And so actually it was a really uplifting, hysterical day, and we were laughing so much at Bully, who can't whistle for shit, and we just had a really, really fun time. I alluded earlier to the fact that my mum went over and lived abroad for a little while when she realised that she could do a lot more in a warmer, drier climate. And unfortunately, that came at a time where my brother was still at home and was still only 17. And so he missed out on some of the things that my sister and I had benefited from, like driving lessons and then buying us our first car and things like that. You know, it became a bit of a bone of contention within the family. By this point, how old was I? I was 25, August. So he would have been 23. So it bubbled on for a few years, but that night, and it wasn't that unusual, I'm not going to lie, but went back to the house, and my brother and my mum had a bit of an argument about things that had gone on, about her leaving and all this kind of stuff. And then my brother left the house, and my dad, I think, went to... No, my dad didn't go to bed. My dad was still sitting downstairs. I went upstairs and was sitting in... And it was kind of like... It was sort of my room, but obviously I'd been away for quite a while by this point. So, yeah. You know, kind of a guest room slash my room, whatever. And my brother's girlfriend at the time was also there. And I remember that very vividly because I have rued a number of times some of the things I said to her, knowing that my mum could hear, although I didn't consider that at the time, but in retrospect. My mum and my brother had this argument. I think my dad was just sitting downstairs. I went upstairs and my brother's ex-girlfriend came in and was talking to me. And I was like, I'm so sorry that this is happening while you're here. You know, it's quite embarrassing. Please just go to bed, get some rest. Don't worry about it. It'll be fine tomorrow. And at the same time that I was talking to her, I could see my mum in my parents' bedroom taking her nighttime tablets, or so I thought. It didn't occur to me at all until the next day that that wasn't quite as it should have been. And so my brother's girlfriend went to bed. I went to bed. I wasn't really aware of anything else that was going on until about 7 o'clock the next morning. And bear in mind, this was like August, beautiful, you know, gorgeous weather until about 9, 10 o'clock. All of us have been drinking all day. And my dad knocked on my door at about 7 o'clock in the morning. So straight away I thought, what the earth is going on here? He's either been up all night or something dreadful's happened. And he said something along the lines of, I think your mum's taken an overdose. And I had a flashback in that moment to her putting her hand up to her mouth and taking the tablets. And then I thought, yeah, that was like way too many tablets for what she would normally take of an evening. And I didn't know what she took. We didn't have conversations about her medication, but you just get used to behaviours, yeah. You know. And I instantly had a flashback and I thought, oh my God. And then I remembered, and I actually, the night before, had completely dismissed it as nothing, which now is ludicrous, quite frankly. She came into my room after I had been speaking to my brother's ex-girlfriend and being like, oh, I'm so sorry, this is really embarrassing, just go and get a good night's kipper and everything will be fine tomorrow. And she came into my room and she was quite teary, and my mum was a Yorkshire Terrier. She didn't do teary, she didn't do emotional. She wasn't cold towards us, but she wasn't like a cuddly, yeah. Kind of, you know, that's not how we were raised. And she was actually choked up and she said, I'm sorry, Gemma, I can't do this anymore. And I said, what else are you going to do? Classic last words.
Hold my beer.
And that is the last thing I ever said to her. And then the next thing I knew, it was about 7 o'clock the next morning, my dad knocked on my door and said, I think your mum might have taken an overdose or something along those lines. It was something, you know, or that horrible phrase, done something stupid, or it was something that, but it alarmed me. And I jumped out of bed and we both went round. So I neglected to mention previously that when she had moved overseas for a while, when she came back, she had a little... like masonette around the corner from the house that they both used to share for a while. When she actually did it, they were back together living in my dad's house, but she went around the corner, and so we went round there and she would ring in the doorbell, look in the letterbox, nothing. Went round to the side, and her bedroom window was right on the edge of the properties, so it's like easy to get to. I started knocking on the window. And nothing, went back round, ring the doorbell, not the letterbox, nothing, went back round. And it was getting to the point where my skin was splitting on my knuckles. I was rapping on the windows that much. And I looked at my dad and I said, I think we're going to have to phone. I said the police. And he just kind of acknowledged. And I started dialing and I just broke down. And he took the phone off me. And he phoned and said, I think my wife took an overdose. And the reason, I might add, which would make a little bit more sense, I suppose, when my dad gone up to bed that evening, my dad went up to bed and my mum said that she had taken 4 boxes of amitriptyline and to get her the cheapest coffin, I remember that my dad said to me that, and you know what, I mean, I said, what else are you going to do? You know, is that kind of response where you just never believe that somebody that close to you is in that moment. And I don't judge him for 1 second for the way he reacted. And he thought she was being a bit melodramatic. And he said, oh, well, you know, if you have, you better phone an ambulance. And he went to bed. But this was the early hours of the morning by this point, and he woke up at 7 o'clock and came knocking on my door. So I think it was in the back of his mind that it was a little bit unusual, and that's when he woke me up. So we phoned whoever it was, the police, the ambulance, can't really remember, and then phoned my brother and my sister for them to come round. My brother got there just after the paramedics turned up, and I can't remember who broke the door down. I'm guessing police, don't really remember. And my brother actually went in and saw her where she was sitting and came out and just nodded at us, and then my sister arrived a little bit after that. And that was it, yeah. No more, Mum.
And now it is time for... Oh, that's not true, mate.
That's a really long one.
Oh, well. This year,
millennium.
We're not talking about a myth that is believed by people who don't suffer. We're going to discuss some of the myths that people who suffer from mental health conditions can believe about themselves. I found this on Instagram from a page that I follow called Real Depression Project, and they're just phenomenal. They do a lot of debunking, a lot of positive reaffirmation. It's just a wonderful, wonderful page, and I'm dropping 3 big green hearts for you. So if you've got a moment, go on to Instagram and follow Real Depression Project. This is from a post they put on called Lies Depression Tells You. The first one is, things will always be this way. That's the lie, because the truth is they're not always this way, are they? I know that in the moment it can be insurmountable and you think that there is no end to what you're going through. But
I really like, sorry to interrupt, I really like, and I want to explain to people that you're looking at me like you're telling me about this, which I like in the sense that, of course, I don't struggle, but this is your story, so tell it to the people.
Thank you. The things will always be this way, and I can guarantee from my own experience that you do feel that way, and it's really hard to see out of the current situation you're in, but it's down to the ebb and flow of life. There are good times, there are bad times, and that's what life's all about. And when things feel like they're always going to be this way, talk to somebody, reach out, and someone will absolutely disprove that lie. The next lie, you're not enough. So it's something that I've definitely felt over the years, where I have behaved in a certain way with Jen because I've projected my own insecurities onto her because I don't feel like I am good enough for her. Sometimes because of my depression, sometimes because of my unwavering ability to always see the worst in myself. And it's just absolute gumph, isn't it, Bab?
Absolutely.
Gumph. It's just a momentary lapse where your mind is trying to make you feel as bad as you possibly can because you're wired differently. But just make sure that you know your worth. And if you don't know your worth, let us know and we'll tell you your worth. Now, this lie is definitely something I've felt, but I'm not going to read the truth out. We're going to talk about our own truth on this one. The lie is, you're a burden. You do feel that way. You do feel that if you didn't have your illness.
People can, almost everybody has had a physical injury, whether it's a broken bone or not, almost everybody's had that, and they can relate to it and identify with it. So it's easier to understand that, how difficult, well, of course it's difficult to climb the stairs when you've got a broken leg. Of course it's difficult to drive. Whereas if you've never struggled with your mental health, then it's very difficult to describe. It's difficult even to really understand it yourself, to begin to describe it. So then if you think that people think you're a burden, you're then not going to want to sit and try and describe all this stuff that you don't really understand yourself, because then you just think you're adding to the problem, I presume.
Spot on.
As someone who lives with and has supported people with mental health issues, I can say that it's never appeared a burden to me. You also can't actually account for the small percentage of people who either have too much else on their own plate, might be struggling themselves undiagnosed, who actually do feel like that situation is a burden. I don't mean the person is never a burden. The situation might be burdensome to people. Circumstance, different things.
We're all human, and sometimes we don't react the way we should react if someone has a moment of crisis and they need support. But like, you just want to point out something you said. It, like, tripping yourself up before you've started, or seeing yourself as an obstacle before you've tried to share that with somebody. If your mind is convinced you're a burden, then before you've even begun to talk to somebody, you're already in the debit column.
Yeah.
You can't, there's no way you can approach that situation with any kind of clarity, because you already feel like just by talking to them, you're being burdensome.
Yeah.
A few people have said this to me, and one of the people recently was Kelly, and she said, I'd much rather hear your, you need to say, because I always get it wrong.
I'd rather listen to your problems than hear your eulogy, or something along those lines, isn't it? I see it in various forms, but I think it was that.
That goes for me. I'd much rather hear your problems and share your worries than read your obituary or hear your eulogy. I think that's absolutely beautiful. The next lie that one can convince themselves of: you'll never get through this. There are times that there are people who don't have mental health worries who do see issues. You know, maybe it could be a financial issue, an emotional issue, where they feel like you're not going to get through this because it's too substantial. Most recently, when you lose people, you think there's no way you can ever recover from it or get through it. But people are resilient. Humans are resilient. And we see it every day. We can't get bogged down with how shitty people are, because that's an easy path to take. We have to remind ourselves just how incredibly resilient we are. And a good way to get through it is by sharing and talking. And when you find like-minded people, or you find someone like Jem, who we should tell that story.
What story?
You should tell that story about the bar. This warmed my ready breakfast, did.
I mean, it's not a very detailed story. It is just the epitome of keep the conversation going. And one of my colleagues' partners very unfortunately took their own life recently. The training, just in case anybody wasn't sure that I'd done some training. This led to me discussing the whole situation of mental ill health and suicide prevention with a different colleague in the bar one night. And then 2 weeks later, I was in there for some leaving drinks with a bunch of folk. And somebody who has been there the whole time that I've been there, but I only spoke to a couple of times sort of in passing, didn't work with them, anything like that, hung around till right at the end and actually came over and said, I overheard you talking about that person's suicide the other week, and how people can feel a burden in the run up to them making that kind of decision, and I've been struggling. I know I really want to talk to you about it. And we were in there for quite a long time chatting, and I thought, this person saw no avenue to speak to anybody despite being in an armed forces environment where it's heavily advertise that there are all these different services and people that you can speak to. He just overheard two people speaking very frankly about a really difficult situation in the bar, and then stewed on it for 2 weeks, and luckily at my leaving drinks had an opportunity to come over and speak to me about it. It has never been more important. Please keep the conversation going.
The final lie we're going to discuss is you're broken and unfixable. I can't talk about all the different variations of mental health issues, such as trauma, PTSD. One thing that I will absolutely say is the one way that you can break this lie yourself is by not stopping and by being inquisitive and finding out if there's anything you can do. You don't have to just take medication at all. You don't have to go, you know, doom scroll through various things on social media. You can read. You can get out and go walking. You can do anything. And I promise you, the moment you start rather than stop is such a beneficial act. First of all, step away from the idea that you're broken and run away from the idea that you need fixing, because you don't. Anyone says to you, just take medication or go and get help, that's not a fix. It's a temporary solution. It's just about not stopping.
It's a process But when you say the word process, I think an awful lot of people think journey. And when you say journey, you think it's a really long thing. But processes happen every moment of every day. And so I know what you're saying about medication and thinking it's not going to be a fix-all for everyone by any stretch. But also for some people, they absolutely need to be medicated for a really, really long time, if not forever. And so it becomes that micro process of taking that tablet every day,
yeah,
and understanding how beneficial that is for you, and that it's no different to someone like me taking my tablets, a type 1 diabetic taking their tablets. It's just, that's what we need to get by, and let's just be grateful that we live in an age that provides us with the medication to exist until old age. In the coming episodes, we really hope to introduce a lot more of the people who've come forward with their own individual struggles, who have mental health issues with which neither Ben nor myself have particular experience. So we hope that will be a really useful insight, and we look forward to welcoming them. And thank you so much for volunteering to speak with our listeners. It is so appreciated.
It really is. Thank you. Keep those messages coming as well, and share anything you can on social media to get that presence out, just to let everyone know that we're going to keep the conversation going.
This episode of Sensing Numbers podcast is dedicated to Matthew Cook, a school friend of mine who left us a few short weeks ago, the father of four beautiful children and a really valuable, wonderful member of society who definitely did not know how much he meant to people. Somebody posted on his timeline on social media, "You look in the mirror and sometimes see a mess of a human being, but you don't see the lives you've touched or the people you've saved. You don't see all the love you've given freely, or the extraordinary memories you've made. You are a book of beautiful moments and feelings."